and testimonies of her parents, printed in her book, Unbound Voices. From 1907 to 1917, a few thousand men and a handful of women from the Punjab area in northern India made their way to North America. The Punjab was a rich agricultural region, but under British rule, many peasant farmers could not pay the high taxes. A famine from 1899 to 1903 decimated their cattle, and the farmers ended up losing their lands. There were Hindus and Muslims among those forced to seek their fortunes in America, but most were followers of the Sikh religion. Judge Brar's father, Kehar Singh, arrived in California in 1913.
Dad and my uncle Dal Singh landed in San Francisco, and they didn't have the $5 apiece to pay the port fee. And for $5, they turned them back. Now, $5 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it was back then.
South Asians arrived in a society that first welcomed cheap labor, then excluded each Asian immigrant group in turn. By the early 1920s, Punjabis fleeing discrimination, racism, and religious persecution were looking to settle. They sought somewhere safe, somewhere rural, to worship and live in peace. That search played a key role in fighting a legal battle that would represent all Asians in America. Chapter 4, Defining American, by Sarah Caswell Colbert.
They worked as farmers. They made their way down California's coast until they settled in Clovis, which is near Fresno in California's Central Valley.
Filmmaker Valerie Kaur has been tracing her grandfather's history with the help of her father, Judge Brar.
Farmers would let them live in barns, and at first they were a little bit hesitant to give them work because they looked so different. My dad used to tell me how, you know, at first it was kind of difficult to get work.
Valerie Kaur named her film company New Moon Productions after the translation of the name of her grandfather's village in India. For her latest film, Divided We Fall, she interviewed her father about her grandfather, whom she calls Babaji.
Why do you think Babaji came to America?
Well, Valerie, I think in those days in India, it was the English that were ruling there, and they pretty much treated the Indians as slaves. My dad and my uncle decided to come here for a better opportunity.
Here in America, Kehar Singh faced legislated discrimination that was directed at all Asians, with special restrictions placed on South Asians.
Due to the Asian Exclusion Acts, my grandfather was not allowed to become a citizen. He was not allowed to own land. He was not allowed to leave the country because he would not be allowed back once he returned. So he could not marry an Indian wife.
The Chinese had the China Exclusion Act in 1882. In 1907, there was a gentleman's agreement between Theodore Roosevelt and the Emperor of Japan, which excluded Japanese. That same year, beginning in 1907, there were executive restrictions put in place by the president to limit the number of South Asians.
Jadeep Singh is a doctoral candidate in ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He points out the pattern of exclusion continued when California passed alien land laws in 1913 and 1920 that kept non-citizens from owning land.
And these laws were specifically directed at Asians, primarily Chinese and Japanese, but also South Asians to an extent. Of course, Asians were very clever and they found ways to evade these laws. For example, the 1913 law had a loophole.
So a lot of the Indians that came in those days married Mexican women or American women, mostly Mexican because they were very similar to Indian women as far as their cooking and their culture was somewhat similar. They would marry those women and they would buy the property in the women's name.
And what many Asians did was to place that land in the name of their children or of a friend's children who were American-born and therefore citizens by birth. By 1920, a second alien land law was passed in California, which closed that loophole. But you had these alien land laws throughout the country, including places like Kansas, that had almost no Asians.
Only citizens could own land, and only whites could become citizens. But two men had the courage to question the definition of white in the courts. Although their cases failed, they brought to light the racism of the court system at the time.
One year they say you're white, but not Caucasian, and the next year they say you're Caucasian, but not white.
By the 1920s, there was a fairly negative feeling in general about immigration to the United States from Asia.
Bruce LeBrac is a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of the Pacific in California.
The first case in which this did deny citizenship to a group of people was the Ozawa case.
In which Ozawa came before the United States Supreme Court and said, look, I went to Berkeley High School, I went to the University of California, we speak English at home, my family goes to a Christian church, we are Americans in every way. He pointed to his skin, he said, look, my skin is actually much whiter than Southern Europeans who have been granted citizenship. So the Supreme Court said that you may be white, but you're not Caucasian.
In 1922, the court ruled against giving Japanese-born Takao Ozawa U.S. citizenship. It supported this decision by saying the founding fathers of America had only intended Caucasians to become citizens.
On the basis of that decision, there was a gentleman named Bhagat Singh Tind, who was a Sikh, who had served in the army in World War I, and he took the case to the Supreme Court, saying that the Indians, at least those in North India, were actually descendants of the original Aryans. They were, ethnologically speaking, biologically speaking, Europeans or Caucasians.
In 1923, Bhagat Singh Tind was denied citizenship by the Supreme Court. The court decided, since the common man mistook the word Caucasian to mean white, being a biological Caucasian wasn't as important as being a free white person.
If you look at the case, it's actually really remarkable. The mental gymnastics that the Supreme Court goes through in order to justify racism. And so as a result of the Thin decision, several dozen South Asians retroactively lost their citizenship.
And they also lost the ability to own land. This was at a time when most Asian immigrants worked in agriculture. These land laws were in effect until after World War II.
As soon as the laws permitted my grandfather to own land, my grandfather bought 40 acres with his brother on Temperance and Bullard.
Valerie Kaur.
And he grew plums and peaches and strawberries. He lived in an old wooden house. There was no tractor. They still used horses. And my father was actually born on this land, and I was born on this land as well.
Judge Brar.
Well, my dad and my uncle, Dal Singh, did not get married until after 1947, and that's when the Asian Exclusion Act was lifted. And so they had an opportunity to go back to India and get married. My dad, of course, in 1950 got married to my mom. They came to this 40 acres that we're on right now.
How did everyone know him? What did everyone
Well, you got a picture. Now, you know, you see a lot of people with turbans and beards. In those days, I was the only Indian at my high school, the entire high school. So you can imagine my dad having a really white beard and wearing a turban. He was very distinctive, and people really liked him, and he knew everybody in town. He always loved this country. So in 72, when he became a citizen, he voted in the next election, and from there on, he never missed an opportunity to vote. And even when he got older, could barely walk, he would have me put him in the truck, and we'd go to the voting booth to vote.
Because her grandfather immigrated to the U.S. with the first wave of South Asians in the early 20th century, Valerie Kaur is one of the few third-generation Sikh Americans. In tracing the journey of Kehar Singh, she's found a connection with all Asian immigrants that shapes her definition of what it means to be American.
Even as the laws that kept my grandfather from becoming a citizen and from owning land were lifted in the 1940s, there have still been moments in our history, in American history, that have made my grandfather and people in my community targets of hate and violence. I think laws only get us so far. I think what is required is a change in the culture itself, to expand the circle of who looks like an American, to include all Americans, so that people with Japanese faces, Chinese faces, Sikhs, Muslims, are seen not as foreigners, not as perpetual foreigners, not as enemies to America, but part of the very American fabric. And the fact that my grandfather has been part of American history since the 1900s makes me believe that only if we can get these stories out to Americans to make them see how diverse the picture of an American really is, only then can we create a community of true respect and solidarity and strength.
Defining American by Catherine Stifter and Sarah Caswell Colbert, with contributing producers Deepa Ranganathan and Rupa Maria. In a moment, a look at the struggle to be a naturalized citizen.
January 1930, a mob attacked a Filipino bunkhouse. And people like Carlos Bulacan are organizing Filipino workers to fight for better wages and better conditions, and also to agitate for citizenship. And so in 1934, the Tynes-McDuffie Act is passed and makes these people who are nationals into aliens. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien, and so it's this kind of 10-year limbo period for, you know, Filipinos in the United States, not really knowing what their status is going to be.
This is Crossing East. I'm George Takei. Find out more about our series at crossingeast.org.
Our actor in this segment of Crossing East was Andre Alcala as the interviewer. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm George Takei. This is Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East. The Immigration Act of 1924 essentially cut off all immigration from Asia for 25 years. By the end of World War II, there were only about 1,500 Sikhs left in the United States. The 1924 Act also affected Filipinos who had been working in the U.S., The U.S. annexed and took over the Philippines after the Spanish-American War in 1898. Filipino bachelors easily entered the U.S. through the 1920s and 30s. They filled the need for cheap labor, working on the sugar plantations in Hawaii, farms in California's Central Valley, and in hotels and restaurants of major cities. But when the Depression hit, jobs were scarce. In 1934, Congress passed the Tynes-McDuffie Act, limiting Filipino immigration to just 50 people a year. Then, in 1935, came the Repatriation Act. Filipinos who volunteered to leave the country were given one-way tickets back to the Philippines if they agreed never to return. Chapter 5, Planting the Seeds of Citizenship, by Stephanie Loleng.
Eudocia Juanitas is a retired Stockton nurse who's small in stature but large in warmth and hospitality. She arrived from the Philippines in 1936.
I was born March 1st, 1911, so I'm 94 years old. There was a Filipino that lived in our place and he came for vacation. So I was looking for a wife. So I agreed.
Many of the immigrants had come expecting to stay only for a few years.
Don Mabalon is assistant professor in the history department at San Francisco State University.
They were going to work, they were going to become rich, they were going to get their college educations, and then they were going to return.
Max Lamar is in his 90s. He came to San Francisco in 1930. First, he bluffed his way into restaurant work, saying he was 18. Eventually, he worked on farms near Stockton.
I told them I was 18. I worked in a restaurant, Filipino restaurant. I put the dishes on the table. Oh, it's not counted hard work.
Max Lamar came to the U.S. as a bachelor.
I was young.
The majority of the population was male. The Filipino-American population before World War II.
Mabalon is third-generation Filipino-American. She grew up in Stockton's Little Manila and is chair of the Little Manila Foundation, a nonprofit organization that works to preserve Filipino history in Stockton.
The population is about 10% female up until the 1940s.
I came right away in the boat. That was in 1936.
Eudocia Juanitas followed her husband to the Central Valley of California, where he worked on a ranch as a labor contractor.
We stayed there in the ranch there for 5 years. They planted celery.
Filipinos kind of fill that labor vacuum in West Coast agriculture. They really become the engine for economic growth in California in the 1920s and 1930s.
My husband was in the farm. They have several men with him. Also in the packing house, I was in charge of taking care of the men that are packing celery. I did the bookkeeping there and watched the men. Even the women have to work in the farm, like packing something in the farm. We were not given high wages. I was receiving only 90 cents an hour at that time, but it was good enough, you know.
Max Lamar shared a small apartment not far from the place where he used to work. Rent was cheap.
You work that time, 8 hours, and then you go home, rest. Then during weekends, I go to dance halls.
Filipinos had been working in the Watsonville, Santa Cruz, Pajaro Valley area throughout the 1920s, becoming a very significant and powerful labor force in that area. In January 1930, it was learned that Filipinos were trying to create a dance hall where it was reported that they would, you know, have contact with white women, which enraged locals in Watsonville.
Monday to Friday, I work in the farm. Saturday, Sunday, I have good time, go to the dance.
Many Filipino men would go to dance halls, wear their finest suits, and mingle with white women.
That's the time when my loneliness go away.
January 1930, a mob attacked Filipino bunkhouse, and Firmin Tobera was killed when he was shot through the heart. People like Carlos Bulosan are organizing Filipino workers to fight for better wages and better conditions and also to agitate for citizenship.
Carlos Bulosan, in his book America is in the Heart, wrote about vigilant Filipino workers, their wholehearted support of the trade union movement, their hatred of low wages and other persecutions against them.
And so in 1934, the Tinies-McDuffie Act is passed. And so it makes these people who are nationals into alien. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien. And so it's this kind of 10-year limbo period for, you know, Filipinos in the United States, not really knowing what their status is going to be.
During World War II, I was inducted in the army, U.S. Army. I went to Honolulu, we stopped there for a while, and then straight to the Philippines. And my brothers and sisters, they introduced me to young Filipino women.
Jean Lamar, Max's wife, remembers the whirlwind romance during his visit to her hometown in the Philippines.
Oh my God, it was a one-month courtship, and at the same time, that's when we got married, September 16, 1945.
And then we have 5 children. 3 girls, 2 boys, married in the Philippines. Lived there for how many years and then come back to America.
The 1946 Loose Seller Act allowed Filipinos who were living in the U.S. to become naturalized citizens. The act was passed right at the end of World War II, after the Philippines was granted independence from the United States.
I work hard to be a citizen. Filipinos, they were good soldiers, very good fighters. So they allowed the Filipinos to be citizens. It's better to be a citizen.
Seeds of Citizenship by Stephanie Loleng with contributor Mia Kim. Citizenship is something that many Americans take for granted, but not the Nisei Japanese, who fought with extraordinary valor as members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the most decorated unit to emerge from the Second World War. They fought even though their families were behind barbed wire incarceration in U.S. internment camps. The Chinese were allowed to become naturalized in 1943, and in 1946, Filipinos and South Asians. Then in 1952, with the McCarran-Walter Act, Koreans, and finally, after Nisei Valor, Japanese were allowed to become U.S. citizens. As the United States left Cambodia in 1975, Pol Pot and his deadly Khmer Rouge regime took control of the country and forced people to move into the countryside to work in what would be known as the killing fields. Those who tried to escape fled to the border of Thailand through minefields to make their way to refugee camps. Between 1975 and 1985, more than 700,000 Southeast Asians arrived in the U.S. 120,000 were Cambodians. Andrew T. was 6 years old when his parents and four sisters came to California. Though his family worked hard, Andrew still grew up in urban poverty. He wanted things he couldn't afford, and he got in trouble with the law for robbery and auto theft. And now, because of a 1996 immigration law, he faces deportation to a country he barely remembers. Our final chapter, Cambodian Deportation, by Robin Takayama.
My name is Andrew T. I am 30 years old. I came to America on September 81. I'm just here to help out because my parent is getting old.
Yeah, he can do like the heavy stuff, loading and mow the lawn, blower, and cut the tree.
It makes the job easier when you have helpers like as me, as his son, and have experience. It makes the job faster.
Andrew has been helping his dad with the gardening business since he was a little kid. His older sister, Singh, says their dad built the business up from nothing when they arrived in the United States.
My dad tried to go to school, learn basic English, and he would help do gardening, help the church, and clean the church up, and they liked the way he worked. That's when he started cutting, you know, grasses and mowing lawn and cutting flowers, and they teach him.
In 1990, over 60% of all Southeast Asian households headed by refugees were on public assistance. That's three times the rate of African Americans and four times the rate of Latinos.
We was very poor. The way we survived, I mean, they give us welfare money. I mean, Medicare just to survive because, come on, we just came to America from Cambodia, you know what I mean?
We would wear, like, mismatched clothes. And the pants was just second-hand clothing. We got it from church.
In the beginning, there were sponsorship programs where the United States called on churches and community organizations to sponsor refugees.
Bill Hing is a professor of law and Asian American studies at UC Davis. He says the U.S. felt obligated to receive the thousands of refugees fleeing the Khmer Rouge. However, he believes the federal government's resettlement plan failed in helping refugees adapt to life in America.
It really was up to the federal government to come up with any other programs. The only kind of programs they really had during those first 10-year periods were a little bit of language training and job training. The rest of your life in that neighborhood, in that community, it's entirely up to you.
Pertira Chim worked with refugees at Cambodian Community Development Inc. in Oakland, California. He says the resettlement plan lacked much-needed mental health and social services, and parents were too overwhelmed with issues of survival to even consider becoming naturalized citizens.
These are folks that suffered through mass starvation, that were highly traumatized, that were called to be farmers and told not to learn by, you know, a regime that murdered you if you were educated whatsoever. And they were expected to come to America and learn history and learn how to read and write when many of these folks didn't know how to read and write in Cambodian. And so, you know, there's a lot of obstacles faced by folks like Andrew.
Maybe it's just the environment is the way your surroundings, the poverty, the place. That's why all the bad things, just crimes, death.
Andrew, who was an honor student and received a scholarship to attend Cal State Hayward, laughs nervously when he recalls the time his life turned in the wrong direction.
I remember my first thing I ever stole was token from the Malibu Grand Prix, like a car race place. You pop the token machine, you reach your hand, you stole the token, you could take the token, go sell, make money back. It was like I got addicted to it. Living in a poverty area, you're not 16 yet, you can't get a license yet. it's just a lifestyle of a teen. You know what I mean? You want to get around, you want to hang around, you want to take your girls out. You know what I mean? You don't have the patience to wait for your parents, to wait for the bus. Hey, you need a ride? Get right there.
I guess maybe he just started hanging around with the wrong friends, and then he's just stealing cars. My dad warned him, you know, what have you been doing? You better stop. And then you might go to jail for a long, long time. My dad did warn him about that. And I guess he didn't really listen.
My first time I got caught was my sophomore year in high school. I got caught, I mean, stealing cars, joyriding, doing what I gotta do, just to have fun. And when I got caught, they sent me to 6 months in camp. Then I go on a home pass, I do some more car burglary, got caught again. Then they sent me almost 2 years total, my first time in juvenile halls. Then I got popped for a robbery somewhere in L.A. Cost me 5 years in prison.
Bill Hing.
For many, many years now, policymakers and the public, I suppose, are upset when they hear that there are immigrants that commit crimes. And that's been embodied in the immigration laws, so that since 1986, there's been additions made to the law to broaden when people can be deported for criminal convictions.
With our situation, not being a citizen, it's totally different from people that being a citizen, right? The unfortunate thing about the Asian is that when you commit crime and you're not a citizen, you finish doing your time, there's another process you have to handle. It's called INS. They will take your paper and they'll ship you back to your country. It doesn't matter how long you've been here.
But prior to 1996, you had a chance to ask a judge, an immigration judge, for a waiver, for forgiveness, basically. Your Honor, let me stay in the United States. I've learned my lesson. I'm rehabilitated now. And if the judge believed you, the judge could grant this waiver and give you your green card back. Well, in 1996, Congress felt that that possibility was too generous. So Congress took away that possibility from any aggravated felon.
Patira Chim.
In many ways, the laws out of 1996 was targeted at, it wasn't just immigration, but welfare reform. And it was clear that America was telling immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our welfare ills.
They could take your life anytime they want by the pick of the draw, the name. To me, sometimes I just feel so helpless. You know what I mean? Like, wow, when is my name called up?
Now he waits for the Immigration and Naturalization Service, currently under the Department of Homeland Security, to call. Although there are more than 1,500 Cambodian Americans to be deported, Cambodia is only accepting a small number each month. So deportees like Andrew do their best to carry on their lives until they are notified their deportation date is scheduled.
I got to face the music when it's time to go. But see, that's the weak point, but it's like you don't know when it is. It might be the next day. I mean, you know, be honest with you, it might be when I get home. And what can you do?
If they're going to deport my brother back to Cambodia, it's going to be really hard because my dad, he traveled 2 feet, walking through muds and through dead body, and he does everything for us to try to get away from that.
I wasn't born here. I was granted to live here, to earn a new life. And I made the wrong choice. I mean, they didn't put a gun to my head, you gotta do this. No, it was my choice. I made it to make some little money, to get better things. But I would do something in my power to show to America, to the world, to the society, to the community, I am a changed person. I mean, everything I do every day is good.
You can leave. I can finish it up. Don't worry about it.
Before, I don't even plan for the future, right? But now I look at the bright side. Whatever happens. That's what it's meant to be. I mean, but while I'm still here, I'm going to make the best of my life and go forward with it.
Cambodian Deportation by Robin Takayama with contributor Mia Kim. We came in many waves, always in search of the American dream, and always excluded. We rose up against injustice and raised new generations of Americans. These are our stories, our history, our America. I've been your host, George Takei.
Crossing East is produced with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Special thanks to Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation and to KQED FM in San Francisco. Our theme music is by Shasta Tycho from their CD Spirit Drum, with additional music by John Jang from his CD Two Flowers on a Stem, and from Angelo Pizarro. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. The managing editor is Catherine Stifter. The associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson. The marketing and outreach director is Ping Ka. The executive producer is D-May Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East and this program, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO.